From deep in the wilds of Pittsfield Township, Michigan, it's the Grace and Paul Pottscast. She's a left-wing conservative Catholic homeschooler who loves to garden. He's a bearded computer geek who reads and writes like he's running out of time. Together, they're raising an ever-growing army of adorkable children and planning the revolution. There we go.
So we're complete now.
We have a guest.
Yay! Welcome, guest.
Elias Krim is joining us.
Hi, everybody.
Hey. So we've got a couple topics, but before we get into them, I want to say a couple things. We are still trying to sell our house. So if anyone is looking for if anyone's looking for a lovely 3,600 square foot home in a beautiful old neighborhood in Saginaw, Michigan.
Yeah.
We're trying to sell ours.
So yeah, it could be yours.
And the listing price is currently $75,000.
Yeah.
One of the people that attended a showing today apparently told our realtor that he would consider offering $20,000.
Oh my God.
So we're kind of like, makes what?
Patience.
Oh yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, we bought it at 128 in 2010.
Yeah. So yeah, yeah. Mm.
And we're in deep trouble. Let's just put it that way.
That's a kind way to put it. That's a kind way to put it. Well,
but there is some good news. Yeah. So last week was our 50th consecutive show.
Yay!
And we started doing this. We did our first summer rerun in this current series of shows last June 18th. Mm-hmm. And then after that, we didn't get a show out for a few weeks. But then we started with conversation number 11 on August 6th.
Nice.
And so since then, we have gotten a show out nearly every Sunday.
Yes, we took a brief hiatus around Christmas.
Yeah, and we've missed one or two, and we've included a couple reruns. But other than that, that's 50.
50 shows. Wow. Yeah.
Question from the floor.
Yes, please.
Are you guys aware, are there very many couples podcasts?
I don't know. Well, actually, I think this is a bit of a thing.
I think it is.
I think it's a thing.
I only know of one other,
yeah,
which may not quite make it a trend.
Yeah.
Not enough.
I'm aware of the Professional Left podcast, which is done by a couple.
Yeah.
Would it? Oh. Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of any others.
No. Really? So, yeah. It seems a little bit oddball, but I think it might be a thing.
It might be a thing.
Yeah.
Well,
I've been listening to Liz and Matt Brunig.
Oh, okay. They do a show together?
A show. And okay. They're very different.
Yeah.
But there's something about these kinds of shows. I don't know what it is. It sort of, in an odd way, reminds me of the really, really old TV and radio show by George Burns and Grace.
Oh, yeah.
Well, ours anyway, I think. Yeah, it's a lot of comedy. Right. So yeah.
We should end it that way.
Kind of comedy. Mm-hmm. It's great to hear, you know.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, good.
Yeah, we should end it. I should say goodnight, Gracie.
Goodnight, Gracie. We've done that joke sometime.
We have. No, I've never, I'm too young to have seen that show back in the day. That was quite a while ago.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But I am kind of aware of this. I've seen bits of it, you know, and quotes from it. But
that's a good one.
Yeah, I'll be 51 years old, and this is our 51st in September, and this is our 51st show. Okay. So,
nice touch.
So, yeah, actually, we wanted to open it up to the audience, too. If you have any ideas what we should do with this
podcast, we'd be open, you know? Like, what should we be doing?
What would you like to hear? If you've been listening for a while, or even this is your first show, what would you like to hear us talk about?
Right. So, and people have told us and given us ideas.
We get a little feedback now and then.
Yeah, and I collected some ideas a while back, and the one that really keeps is hanging with me that I haven't finished the research on Well, yeah, yeah, because I really want to do a coherent show on the American Revolution.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been sitting for a while. I haven't forgotten.
I'd love for you to be able to do that. It's to do it properly, as you point out, requires a significant amount of research and preparation.
Yeah. prep. Well, yeah, prep more than the research. Yeah. I've got a lot of it.
Okay.
Like, sort of at hand, but I need to organize it and prep it.
Yeah.
For a coherent presentation.
Yeah, there are some great history podcasts that I listen to.
Yeah, and I'm just a little hesitant. I'm not doing a history podcast.
Right. Your goal isn't to jump into that.
Yeah, I'm not doing that. Lots of people are doing it really well. I don't want to say anything about that. I really do want to do a little bit more interpretive work.
Yeah, yeah.
And use that information to help people think about what it means. Versus just, you know, exposing the information.
Maybe you can get people to get their heads straight about Hamilton.
For example.
That would be good.
Yeah, I mean, no, and don't get me wrong, I love the music. It was well done.
Yeah.
My children have all listened to it and know many of the songs. It's great.
Joshua had parts of it memorized.
Yeah, I'm not making some kind of claim about how horrible rap music it is and how it shouldn't be connected to the American Revolution. It's just a little bit perverse to lionize a man like Hamilton.
The way that it does. And even he based it on Cherno's biography.
Right.
Which does not entirely lionize Hamilton.
It's a little more honest than the musical is.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that.
So now, mind you,
It's still a little neoliberalized, I think.
Cherno handles them with kid gloves.
Yeah.
He doesn't call them out.
Okay.
I mean, the Whiskey Rebellion was his thing.
Yeah. No, I listened, and during my commuting, I listened to Cherno's books on Washington and Hamilton. The audiobooks are abridged, so this I didn't get the whole experience, which would have been like a 30-hour audiobook.
Journey of
But
faith.
I did the best I could.
Yeah.
And they were quite interesting, but he does
handle them with kid gloves.
Yeah, both of them to some extent. Yeah. Right.
So I'm aware of that, and that's still on the deck for me. But I'm open to other ideas and other suggestions about what we should do, and what the show should be, and what people want to hear.
Yeah, I'm wanting to do more rather than less time. Whereas some of my friends are saying it was 2 hours. I couldn't listen to it. I'm like, well, did he try the 4-hour one?
Right.
Because to me, the cure for too much is more.
Is more, you know. Yeah. Yeah. No, we'll talk. Yeah, talk. I'm not sure what a half-hour show would look like by us.
We can't even take.
Well, no. Right.
Yeah.
It would be Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood anyway.
Which, you know, has its merits.
By the time we got our cardigans on and our shoes changed, it would be
over.
Yep. All right. So, but we talked about longer show. We talked about I don't think we can go more than one day a week. We're already like abandoning children.
Yeah, it's all we can do to get this one out.
But do you want to do longer, do more prep? I'd like to add live music. I'd like to do more production stuff, like more audio clips and stuff like that, which I just, you know, I'm trying to produce the thing and finish it by 1:30 or 2 a.m. on Sunday night. And, you know, it's literally all I can do to get it out and still make it to work the next morning.
Right. So ideas welcome.
Yep.
Yeah, but no, we brought Elias on the show to follow up.
Yeah, he joined us at the start of July.
Start of July, we figured, here it's the start of September, let's see what's happened.
Yeah,
so how's the book coming? I know you're working on a book about your trip to Russia.
Yeah. I'm enjoying it and realizing that this is a little bit larger subject than I thought. It is still a travel book. Funny old photo. I recently had lunch with a guy who was on the trip with me.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. He was the guy who was our designated Russian translator.
Mm-hmm.
He was a South Side Chicago Irishman. A very funny, wonderful, wonderfully smart guy who spoke French, Russian, and Polish.
Well, all right.
Because he was writing a dissertation on sort of the contrast between Polish and Russian history books of the 20th century.
Oh, yeah. They're going to be different.
Imagine what that might be. Anyway, a very wonderful guy. And we never quite knew what he was up to until sometime after this trip back in 1938, when we discovered he was finishing at a Jesuit seminary.
Oh.
He became a Jesuit, wound up moving to Rome and running one of the institutes in Rome. This one was for the Oriental Church.
Mm-hmm.
And all kinds of other interesting things. But a wonderful storyteller who'd been to the Soviet Union and then Russia many times. And he and I, as I say, got together a couple of months ago and just had a great time kind of reliving some of the trip. So that freshened up my memories.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I was telling him, as long as I'm going to try to build this little soapbox, one of the things I wanted to talk about is the way I now see the Cold War very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been reading a bit about that and realizing that in a way, you know, I got some of it on the trip, meaning Russia, what Russia really was. And Russia. And then in other ways, I definitely had a kind of a blinder on. And now I'm looking at kind of the larger picture and the way in which that empire, in many ways, now I see resembles our empire.
Yeah. Go figure. Isn't that weird? Yeah. That's kind of weird.
Yep.
Yeah. And to be clear, I keep saying Russia, and it's Russia, but at the time it was the Soviet Union.
Soviet Union.
Right. And so you were behind the Iron Curtain.
I was.
In the Soviet Union in 78.
Yep.
Yeah.
So at that time, it looked like it was holding together very nicely. It was in a kind of a defensive posture. Brezhnev was not trying so much to export revolution as he was just to productively hold things together while kind of quietly persecuting dissidents.
Right.
That's pretty much the order of the day
when
we in 1978. Mm-hmm. So the cracks were not too apparent. But now looking back on it, I can see them a bit. And I see that, you know, when I compare surveillance with surveillance, when I see kind of social breakdown with social breakdown, it's really interesting to have that point of reference.
Right.
Because at the time, you know, I had no sense that these two great imperial schemes had anything at all in common.
Right. They were polar opposites to hear anyone tell the story.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. So then there's this whole Girardian thing about, you know, mimesis and the way, you know, not only individuals, but I guess whole societies sort of imitate the other.
Yeah.
And in some ways we have turned into our adversary without knowing.
Yeah.
Some of that kind of crazy speculation is what I'd love to dabble in.
Right. Well, and like it's not so we've turned into this other, right? Our reviled enemy.
We have, you know, they did it in a very analog fashion. Right. Surveillance when I was there meant that they already had our itinerary. They knew our license plate number. We were driving down designated roads and could not leave those roads, attracting attention.
Right.
And so we had a certain kind of surveillance in a very kind of old-fashioned way.
Right.
Minders.
Yeah, he had minders.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So the truth was, as it was explained to us, as long as we did not really wake up the elephant, everything was fine.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you just didn't want to wake up the elephant because then there was no putting it back to sleep.
Right.
But that's not at all. I mean, after all, the biggest difference is that in those days, I mean, what was going on in the Soviet Union was not voluntary. People were not offering, really, their information to the state in order to keep tabs on them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But we've figured out a way to do that.
Just get around that little...
Right? We're creating our own...
Yes.
Yeah.
People are eager to give away everything about themselves.
Right. To the state...
So there's that whole thing.
Yeah, and when we sort of invert it in that way.
That's right.
Like, suddenly it's not the same thing.
Yeah, inverted totalitarianism.
Right. That, like, oh, it's, this is all voluntary, so it's fine, right?
No, right. Right, right. So, wow. And you know, the other thing about the trip that I've been thinking about is that the guy that organized the trip made the point in the brochure that this was a trip in order to give us maximum access to Russian citizens. And I didn't particularly think about that, mm-hmm. but he had a kind of agenda. And the agenda was to create a trip where there was so much camping and driving mm-hmm. that surveillance was much more difficult to do. We're out there at the campgrounds with ordinary Russians hanging out. Right. And we can talk to them and hear from them. And that was really a fantastic thing. It was not one of these prepackaged things in a tour bus where you had the guide from the Soviet tourist agency reading you the official line. We had that, but we also had plenty of time to hang out with just ordinary Russians. And that was the great thing.
Mm-hmm. So what I heard from like friends and family who had been on like sponsored tours and official tours and whatnot was that they'd, whenever their tour bus was going through a neighborhood, they had the tour guide who was saying, and now if you look out on the left and then say, you know, this cathedral, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And if you looked out on the right, you saw the thing that you weren't supposed to be looking at. And that's why they were trying to, you saw the poor tenement or whatnot, you know.
That's right.
Right.
So I had a number of impressions, and some of them were more accurate than others, I guess, mm-hmm. given that I had a certain kind of ideological blinders on. But I've been thinking more about the people and just really a larger subject, which I'll try to weave into the book. And that is, I think there is a way in which it is true, as Russian intellectuals and theologians have argued for a long time, there is something different about Russia, and there's this idea that there's a Russian fate, and the Russian fate is to teach the rest of the world a certain kind of lesson, which can mean different things.
Right, you can take that two or three ways.
That's right, that's right. But as I learned more about Russian history and what we were seeing, you know, in the Ukraine near Stalingrad, and just the unbelievable story of these people and what they've been through in the last century or so. There are many, many things to reflect on there that are very foreign to the experience of the West, and particularly America.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we need to understand it better. Mm-hmm.
I find it, as a, you know, literature guy, I always find it really fascinating to read Russian novels, and particularly Russian science fiction and dystopian fiction, because to me, they have the darkest, grimmest takes on things. Ice Trilogy, there's a trilogy of novels called Ice Trilogy, which is deeply disturbing and grim and weird.
Yeah.
And then also the Strugatsky brothers that did...
Oh, that thing in the park, not the park, but like the...
The Zone.
The Zone.
Yeah, Roadside Picnic. Yeah. Very, very dark worldview, but fascinating. So I'm always drawn to some of these...
I would love to see those.
Some of these Russian novels.
An old comment that Russians are not moderates. They are not in the middle.
Nope.
Everything.
Whatever it is.
Definitely extreme in one way or the other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a certain, it echoes something I like to say about Detroit and Michigan, about how, you know, Detroit is the needle every American city has to pass through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's, Russia's got some of that, you know.
It does.
Our lived experience is something that all humanity will have to come to understand.
Oh, yeah, the collapse of an industrialized society.
Yeah, everyone's going to have to, well, and it's not just like a modern thing.
Right.
This is a Russian theme that goes way back.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah, so like the fall of their monarchy, the fall of their...
Yeah.
All that sort of like somewhat presages a lot of other falls.
All revolution after revolution. Yeah.
And it's a learning that, you know, everyone needs to get that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can learn this lesson from us.
Yeah.
So yeah. That also, though, implies that we should go there now and check out what our future is going to look like.
Precisely, right? Yeah. What's coming for us?
Yeah.
And similarly with the state of Michigan for the state of, for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to wrestle with this somehow.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful Russian guy named Dmitry Orlov, who's been
interviewed
by Chancellor, right?
Yeah.
And oh, yeah.
He has a book called Reinventing Collapse.
Mm-hmm.
It was back in that vogue of books around civilizational collapse. But his is very insightful because he's using the old Soviet experience to say, you know, this is what it looks like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is what it looks like. You can do it too.
Yeah. Where it seems like an awful lot of Americans just they don't believe that any of this could happen.
No.
Because it's... No. The trend is always upwards.
A lot of Americans have their fingers in their ear, while they sing la 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 la. I'm just gonna go to work and pretend this isn't happening.
Yeah, yeah.
We're the exception. We're exceptionalism.
Well, not us.
Yeah, here.
I know, right. I know, but right. Not us.
No.
So
it's wonderful, deep stuff, and so I'm hoping to finish it up in a couple months, maybe, and then. I don't know if anyone will pay the slightest attention, but I'm trying to make it entertaining and really more of a travel book and not so much of a sermon, for crying out loud. So,
yeah. Well, we're really looking forward to reading it.
We're looking forward to it, yeah. And I think a few weeks back, maybe even 2 months back now, you went to a socialism conference in Chicago.
Ah, I did. Yeah. That was such a wonderful, weird little excursion. You know, I got to say that part of the fun of this is that, as you guys know, I'm a boomer. I'm one of these guys. I mean, I always had the idea.
You admit that in public still? Or
after age 50, there's some rule somewhere that says you're really not supposed to change your mind about anything. You know?
Yeah.
And I it's just astonishing to me how much I've changed my mind about.
That's funny.
Right, yeah. Right.
I can't quite explain it. I give Pope Francis some of the blame.
Mm-hmm. He should be blamed for everything.
They should. 2008 gets a lot, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so part of my revision of my Cold War understanding also has to do with other kinds of political systems, and there's lots of buzz about socialism and all that. And I saw this conference was coming to Chicago, which is an old socialist city.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyways, a lot of history there. And I thought, you know, this would just be a fun errand to go sit in, you know, sort of Hunter Thompson style.
Are you starting out with the ether and then and then the acid kicked in and all that? I hope not.
I hope not.
You know, just go do some gonzo thing here.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that sounded like a little more than I was really up for, but it was fun. It was great fun to go to this rather nice, thoroughly expensive neoliberal hotel in the South Loop and hang out with, I think, I don't know, 300-400 people.
Oh, good.
That's a sizable gathering. Yeah, that's all right.
Shapes and sizes. And it was, it reminded me in some ways of an overblown teach-in.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
There were a number of people there, some older, some not quite so old, but they're doing workshops, numerous workshops that were dissecting previous revolutions.
Hmm.
And we were sifting through the ruins, trying to figure out what could we learn here, what went wrong, you know, why did this not follow good ideological principles, what broke down, all kinds of different things. You know, it was Portugal, and it was the Russian Revolution, and it was France in 68. Mm. And,
you know,
a very interesting, slightly wonky kind of effort to try to get our minds around what all that was about.
Right.
And then there were numerous other workshops that were more about sort of identity politics and things like that. But it was sort of a weird combination of kind of a pep rally. Every time there was a general session, things got a little rowdy and edgy and fun. And we started chanting about abolishing ICE and stuff like that.
Oh, that's always good.
And then we would break up and go to the workshop on the Egyptian Revolution of 2011.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
Wow. So it was sort of fun. It was sponsored by the International Socialist Organization, which is a particular kind of approach to this and works out of classical Marxism and Leninism to some degree, but is not communist. And then the other thing I concluded after sort of browsing the rather nice bookstore they had here, had on site, was that they are not interested in certain other kinds of approaches, which would be thought of, I guess, as certainly social democracy, expect some kinds of democratic socialism, and certainly nothing at all to do with figures that came out of any kind of religious-oriented socialism or revolutionary tradition.
Right.
So there's no Dorothy Day, no King, you know, very little of solidarity, that kind of thing. Just not really a subject.
That's disappointing to hear.
It is disappointing.
Because Grace and I are busily trying to actually broaden our understanding of socialisms, you know, and recently we just started reading The Conquest of Bread, Kropotkin, and I'm trying to wrap my head around some of these anarchist thinkers that people have been recommending to me. And look more at non-authoritarian, non-statist, you know, more distributed, more, you know, egalitarian socialisms.
This seemed to be focused really almost entirely, exclusively on how to create a workers' movement. Which is in one way an important focus, but it also meant that other kinds of social efforts relating to, you know, other kinds of ownership or agriculture or, you know, Kropotkin did not come up. Just, there really was very little, as far as I could find, of that. So really more just kind of conventional and old style radical organizing. And, you know, as I think about it, one of the odd things about that is the unspoken assumption that we're still talking about organizing at a workplace.
Not addressing that assumption. So can I just step back just a little bit here and just no wrong answers. I want to hear what you how would you describe or separate socialism from communism? How are they different?
Communism is clearly the state seizing control of all means of production.
Okay.
Therefore, there is a vanguard elite that becomes the party. The party makes all the decisions, runs the military, the security, and so it's the power base.
Right.
The various socialisms come up with, I guess, different degrees of state involvement, but I would say, as far as I understand, don't assume that the state is seizing all of the means of production in this rather totalizing way.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, are there other communisms that are, that sounds like state communism.
Yes. Well,
there's like anarcho-communism. People talk about our anarcho-communism, our anarcho-syndicalism, which is, you know, communism, but no state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, actually, communism without a state sounds like distributism to me.
Right. Yeah, we're still trying to wrap our heads around this because, you know, people don't you know, come out of school typically having studied socialist revolutions.
And like have a working vocabulary around the subject. And I keep running into people with like just radically different vocabulary. Yeah. Like they're using the same words.
Yeah.
But the vocabulary definition is just something else.
The one I've been trying to work out and come up with, really bring into focus recently, have been words I see kicked around all the time. It's the difference between progressivism and leftism or left organizing versus the progressive movement. Yeah. And I try to, so like, okay, historically, what comprised the progressive movement? And it sounds a little bit, you were talking about how this socialist conference, they seemed very focused on labor And that to me is like the progressive movement is to me very focused on labor, but not necessarily about overturning, you know, the system. It's trying to make the system more just, you know, more remunerative to the workers and, you know, and literally it was a matter of saving lives too. You know, that came out of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire and things like that. But to me, that's progressivism. But I can't get people to understand why that's not like the only leftist worldview.
Right. Know? No, so. The only thing on the left.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I really do wonder, as I was hanging out with these younger people, I said in the article, I didn't mean to be snarky, I guess, but I said, you know, they look like a whole group of sort of angry skateboarders.
No, but I get
those,
it.
Those were the anarchists.
Those are the anarchists, yeah.
Looking and, you know, the guy at the podium and say, all right, I recognize the comrade with the pink hair.
Yeah, thank you.
We called each other comrade, by
that's
the way.
That's funny, yeah. Well, they do this even at our local DSA.
They call it really comrade.
The group emails that go out to, well, actually they say, the news emails that go out to everyone on their mailing list, they say friends and comrades, I think.
Friends and comrades, right.
Today we actually went briefly to the local chapter, Labor Day DSA picnic, which was fun.
Oh, yeah. Glad to be there.
Don't you think the opportunity here might be the fact that we're at a moment where, truthfully, no one really has a very firm definition of what this word means?
Precisely.
Yeah, I think that's the old. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What it means is I am not going to let the Democrats do this to me one more time.
Am I right? You know, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Not again.
Not
hold
again.
The damn football.
There's certainly a lot of energy around that particular feeling.
Yeah, right there.
At least that. I mean, that's not exactly a program, but it's a starting point.
But something. It's, you know, it's a start. Yeah, it's a starting point.
I want
to. It's not a funeral.
I want to see if we can get on the show sometime someone who was at the Pittsburgh Rust Belt DSA conference, because that was a thing that happened recently too, and I was trying to figure out if I could possibly go, and it just wasn't in
the cards,
budget and time and whatnot. But I'm sure that some people from our local Huron Valley DSA chapter went, and I'd like to see if I can get a debrief
on what happened. What happened there? Oh, goodness. And just catch us up a little bit on Solidarity Hall. I've heard murmurs about new stuff in the pipeline, but
I'm just doing a little blogging, and I'm making a few people nervous as we seem to be moving toward a more focused, kind of an activist, you know, set of ideas and so forth.
Ruffled.
Because I think it's time. Okay, excuse me. I think it's time.
It's time to do something.
Yeah. Right. Clock is ticking mildly. So I've been dabbling in. Pete Davis and I are interested in this movement from South America. The Argentine word for it is horizontalidad.
Mm.
Horizontalism.
It's
a form of anarchism, but it's really about the cities, and the proposition is, the city has replaced the factory as the revolutionary arena.
Right on.
Interesting. Yeah.
So what's going on in Barcelona? The New Yorker has a piece profiling the mayor, this woman mayor of Barcelona. Mm-hmm. And he is all about this municipalism movement, which is really a wonderful thing, because what I see in it is that it plays into sustainability, localism, radical subsidiarity. It's got lots of great ingredients.
Yeah, all the good pieces are there. All the pieces are there. It's, you know, whether or not you can actually organize it into, you know, what it needs to be is another question, but all the pieces are there.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've realized this is not about a system of autarky where we're just saying we're going to pull up the gates and sustain just our city. There is a confederal dimension here. So it's my city and your city and three or four other cities. And at that level, we are collaborating.
Yeah.
And trading best practices and trading literally, maybe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so it's what it represents in a way is the breakdown of the federal system. I mean, where do you go?
Right.
You get this locally. And this gets really very interesting and very radical.
Yes. Yes. And I think it's important to note that there will be some really magnificent wins.
Yeah.
And some pretty tragic losses in that process.
No doubt. Yep.
Yeah. I don't want to be, I don't want to sugarcoat that or be sanguine or no, pretend that's not true.
It's not a controllable process.
Right. And sure. I really feel like the folks who are always like, well, anarchy, how's that going to work? And I'm like, I don't know. Let's try it. and really they're like, so all these terrible things can happen. I'm like, yeah. And all these terrible things are happening. Right. So I don't know. Let's try something new.
Yeah.
It would seem that they can only work as well as the health of your own community.
Yes. Yes.
And that's all we're talking about.
And we have some communities that are really in trouble.
Yep. That's right.
I mean, really. I mean, just terrible fractures in all dimensions.
People might not realize that they just at the start of the school year, so the school year is about to start in the Detroit public school system, they shut off the water in a whole bunch of school buildings.
The entire school system.
Everyone?
Every school in the Detroit public schools
because
has no water.
They were all testing with such high lead and copper levels.
Yes, the water's not safe to drink. They can't make it safe to drink.
Yeah, and... You know, so now what?
So how's that going to work? Yeah. Well, you know what comes next?
What comes next?
The city buys Michigan's water back from Nestle.
Yeah.
Ugh.
That's the next step.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we could talk about Marathon and their polluting in the city of Detroit. Yeah. And we could talk about, there's so many things we could talk about, right?
Right.
But the deal is... And I really hope Detroit hasn't missed this window.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a moment in the last 10 years, and I think the energy and the moment is still open, where Detroit could belong to Detroit.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That Detroit was available for Detroiters.
To own.
To own.
Literally. Local control.
And to do something with.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not willing to say that moment has passed or is gone and is irretrievable, but the window's closing on that.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. You're saying you hope maybe Detroit will actually enact on a sizable scale what Jackson, Mississippi is trying to do on a relatively small scale.
Modest scale. Yes. Yes.
Wow. That'd be wild. That'd be great.
It would be amazing. It would be amazing. You know? And I could see a lot of people coming back for that.
And that's one of the only things that has kept Saginaw livable, even as it is the fact that Saginaw owns its water plant.
Owns its water.
Yeah.
Some of the best water in the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whenever Isaac's friends would come and visit us, they'd bring water jugs and
fill up
with our tap water.
Because they wanted to take their
to bring back to Ann Arbor.
Right, because the tap water was so good. Yeah, yeah. And that's been a boondoggle for the people in Saginaw, but it's a huge livability factor.
Yes.
Yep.
Right? That the water is clean and functional. There's potable water here.
Mm-hmm.
So
some of the water mains are still made of wood and still falling apart in the winter.
And mind you, that's less frequent than you would think with, you know, 19th century water mains that are made out of wood.
Right.
They still work.
They still work. And so at least they don't leach lead.
Bingo. You know, details. You know what I'm saying? Details. Oops. Sorry. Yep. Small malfunction. But we're okay. Everyone's safe. But no, this municipality thing is very exciting. So you and Pete Davis are working on that, not to derail you.
We're going to be interviewing a guy that writes for a magazine called Roar Magazine.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
A little aggressive. Mm-hmm. But no, quite an interesting magazine of the left. And they've been focused a bit. I've done some coverage on this kind of direct democracy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, participatory budgeting. I mean, you know, how come everybody else has figured this out? And here in America, you know,
we're like,
Yeah. So Barcelona and Medellin, Colombia, and which is a complete turnaround story. It's now a wonderful place to be, evidently.
Yeah.
and so on. But we're still trying to figure out how to get there. But it's really quite fascinating stuff.
That's some good stuff. I mean, and I think there is something that we should think about vis-a-vis, like, so how come we haven't figured some of these things out yet here?
Yeah.
I think we have, and we've actively forestalled it.
Chose them not to.
Right. Yeah. Like, for example, there's, I think, and I've talked about this before, how Michigan effectively outlawed, they made home rule of municipalities illegal back in the 60s. So, like, correct, we thought about that and said, oh, we can't let that happen.
Indiana did the same.
Right. So on a state level, we have thought about this.
Right.
And made sure we can't have it.
No, yes, that's right.
And I think that's not, Michigan and Indiana aren't dramatic outliers in that respect, where a lot of this municipality has been forestalled actively at a state level.
Yeah.
So the federal government doesn't even have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But, you know, that state law is not necessarily part of the Constitution.
That's right.
I believe there's things we can do about that.
No, right, right. Well, let me tell you a funny thing, not Solidarity Hall, but just in my own backyard here. Downtown, there is a juice bar. And the juice bar has been owned now for 2 or 3 years by a very nice couple. The guy had a job in Chicago, rather nice job. He dumped the job, bought the juice bar, and then he got drawn into his neighborhood and what was going on in sort of neighborhood development.
Mm-hmm.
And he got pretty good at it. And he also got interested in strong towns.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So he had a great conversation about strong towns. And now he is seriously noodling a run for mayor.
Oh, hey.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. So I've been saying to him, Bill, you know, the reason I'm interested is not because I care about these partisan debates or anything close to that. I think we could find a group of people in our little leafy college town who are interested in a different kind of development, a different way of going forward. What we have right now is sort of economic hunting, not economic gardening.
Right.
We have a proposal for a big transportation-oriented district project, which is built to a finished state, as Chuck Marone likes to put it. Mm-hmm. It's a big bang project. It's tens of millions of dollars. It will make money for a rather small number of people.
Mm-hmm.
It will temporarily employ some local tradespeople. But it is not incremental. It is not fine-grained. It does not build urbanism.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has any idea what it's going to do to parking or the kind of dynamics of the downtown, since it's just adjacent to downtown. But somebody needs to run and talk about this. And so this guy at the juice bar, my friend Bill, who's a wonderful, bright guy and really is into strong towns, really understands what Chuck's talking about, he is about to announce, and I'm very excited because in my town, maybe like in a lot of little, even red towns, there is really something bubbling.
Yes.
And it's great.
Yeah, it's palpable. Palpable.
It might run the tables. I don't know.
Yeah.
The other side is just on fire. And you know, their idea of development is to act like a bunch of crazy free-spending liberals and make these big bets on projects that may or may not work.
See what happens.
And actually go to the right of that and say, no, let's do lots of incremental projects. Let's focus on our backyard businesses. Let's build up the downtown retailers and so on. And right. I think that is a winning story.
It's a winning solution.
Yeah, that does sound like, from having heard Chuck lecture about that, that does sound like the approach of, you know, fund 100 projects, not one. or 1,000.
Right. Yeah, I mean, really, let's do something for real.
Yeah, and I think the other plank in the platform that will be a winner is to just run on transparency.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah. But that's the strong towns, this piece of the strong towns message.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you do one project and you put all your eggs in that basket.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't pan out.
Right.
you know, but let's say you do 100 projects,
yep,
and 75 of them don't work out.
Right.
You have 25 successful projects,
right,
for the price of the one that failed.
Yep. Oh, right.
Right?
And yeah, and he's talked about how some of those projects can be extremely modest, like just paint bike lanes or put in some flower
plants. Flowers out there. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be a big deal.
They can start small, you right. know, trying to turn a, make yeah. a Strode more drivable, you know.
Well, and some of these municipal projects, you see them, like they include like the flower baskets, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the line item in the big project for the flower baskets is like $250,000 or, you know, $1 million for flower baskets downtown. Mm-hmm. And you say to yourself,
who got the flower basket contract? I know. Whose brother-in-law runs the florist?
Runs the florist, right? And got the contract to keep them watered every day, you know what I mean? Yeah. So the when you do this sort of modest thing, this incremental thing, mm-hmm. no one's spending $250,000 on flower baskets.
Yeah.
That's not happening.
That's right.
And yeah, yeah. I know there's all kinds of pushback about why it costs $250,000, but yeah, sure. no.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're all rational people, and we know that that's not what flower baskets cost.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, what I'm wondering is if there is a certain population number above which things begin to change around your city hall, or maybe they should change around your city hall.
It should be so different. Yeah.
We're a town, you know, a friend of mine is very conspiracy minded, and he believes that all of the bad actors, in his view, down around city hall and the developers, they all meet late at night while we're asleep, and they come up with these schemes. And I've tried to explain to him and say, look, no, man, that's not the explanation. The explanation is all these people went to high school together.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
That's it's that
they trust each other.
And they and they meet at the diner at 8 a.m., you know, not the middle of the night.
No, they meet at the diner at 8 a.m. in broad daylight in a public location. You could sit at the table next to them.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what we got to do is face the fact that after the town gets to a certain size, it sometimes happens you've got to do business differently.
Yes.
You've got to get out of this paternal thing.
Right.
Right?
Right. And you know, this friend network thing.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's just, it's so easy to do, but, you know, it has very bad effects. And our town likes to talk about how we're so civically engaged, and then City Hall does things to disengage us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. We were talking about that at the picnic.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of the people at the DSA picnic are local folks who are trying to get some organizing done with groups working with City Hall, you know, so with the City Council. And
disengage them at every turn.
Yeah, just the way they try to pry them off of the, you know, try to minimize their work and shuttle them into stuff them back in their box and their corner, their penalty box, you know, it's really, even just hearing the story is frustrating. It's hard to imagine
living it,
trying to do it every day. If this is your activism,
there's a kind of a syndrome, and it's something about defensiveness and some kind of fear of the public or the idea of the trouble. The public's just going to screw this up. You know, if you try to engage them and start holding charrettes, God forbid.
Oh, my God, not that.
You know, no good can come of that.
Well, no, and it's kind of like, you know, the 10th graders, they're having a sleepover. And if they invite the new girl, it won't be the party they had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. If you invite the people, the outsiders, to your party, then it's not going to be the party you were thinking of.
Right.
No. Control.
Control. And I find most of us in most spheres of our life are still in the 10th grade.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, don't invite the weird kids, you know, we don't talk to them.
That's true.
It'll be bad.
That's true.
So you can't, you know, they can't participate.
Yeah.
And
I think the way to do this, though, I'll give you my personal strategy.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I think I mentioned this the last time we talked. I'm trying to be a goo-goo. Mayor Daley's old term for the people from Hyde Park that come up and always want to talk about good government.
Yes.
It just drives me crazy. You know, you know, they're just so, so impossible. But I try to come on not as a crazy radical, but as a goo-goo. And then we quietly sort of smuggle in. I mean, this is Indiana.
Smuggle the radicalism under the radar. It's best place for it.
At night when nobody's around.
Right. Why do you think we record in the middle of the night?
Yeah. Why am I still uploading this at 2 a.m.?
Right.
I think that's the only way we're going to get it done.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why we do it.
No, so that's, I think you're onto something. Did I put a bug in your ear already about sociocracy?
Let's see. I sort of vaguely know this word, but I don't really remember what it is.
Yeah. It's branded for American audiences as dynamic governance because Americans get frightened when they hear social things.
Oh, yeah, right.
Right. So, but in Europe and other places where people have used this, it's they call it sociocracy.
Yeah.
And it's was developed as a business governance model that's more democratic. And in fact, really deeply democratic. The book I would recommend is Getting to a Deeper Democracy.
Okay.
I'll verify that title so I can put it in the show notes. But it's a very good book, and that's written for an American audience.
Cool.
But let me see if I can summarize it very quickly.
Okay.
So, and how it would work, say, in a political setting of a polity. So let's say we have wards, and we have city council and so on. And then in many places, wards are broken down even further.
Yep.
So let's take your smallest unit, say a neighborhood or a precinct. That neighborhood or precinct would elect, but I use that term loosely, because you can't run.
Yeah.
Everybody votes for the person they think would do the best job. And the top two winners, because remember, nobody's running, but everybody's voting. And they select the members of their community they think would really represent them well. Those two individuals now have a role at the next level of government.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that's the ward. So they manage your ward. So those two people like represent the precinct and they go to the ward. And in the ward, all the precincts have a couple of people from each precinct going to the ward to manage things that need to be managed in this sort of like horizontal fashion.
Uh-huh.
Now, mind you, what this is integrating horizontal organization so that you can confederate across a wide area.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So every person who's in some like senior level, whatever it might be, if you want to, or, you know, think about it as a hierarchy, got there because the individuals in their community of origin thought they were the best person for the job.
Mm-hmm.
Not, and I have to emphasize this, not because they ran for the position. So no one, there's no campaigning here.
Huh.
There's no campaigning. There's no like anything. Huh. So in a work setting, you know, let's say you've got a job unit that does accounting and, you know, you need to represent like what accounting's needs to the next level. The accounting office would say, well, who do you think here should be doing that? And everyone by secret ballot would say who they think should be doing that. The name that comes up the most is the name that does it.
Hmm.
And so on. And there's a danger of a popularity contest.
Yeah.
But that's why you take two people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Huh. You can usually break that kind of popularity contest dynamic by taking the top two names because they're not necessarily, you might think they might be the two most popular people. It's usually a popular person and an extremely competent person is what usually happens.
Oh, that's it.
Huh. And the combination of the charisma of the popular person and the competence of the competent person gets a lot done.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So that's the nuts and bolts of it. And they've done like some experimentation at a very low level of how you might use this to manage a large federation. And many corporate entities throughout Europe use sociocracy to democratize their workplace as a functional method of government.
Wow, cool. Hmm.
So check it out.
I'm on the website right now, and I want to see if you're aware of their blog post about strong towns.
Oh, I haven't read that yet. No, that's amazing.
Can you believe this? I am on the sociocracy.info website.
Right on.
Oh, this,
and they're talking about Strong Towns. Of course they are, right?
That's hilarious.
Sociocracy in Civic Life.
Mm-hmm.
The title of the post is Strong Towns and a Way Forward.
Yeah.
And it says, the organization's methods for building strong towns are distinctively sociocratic.
Yeah.
Entirely practical and nicely framed. No unfamiliar names or distracting variations accepted practices.
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
Yeah.
Cool.
No, so that's that. I think that needs to be a conversation about municipalism and home rule and sort of local governance, because there's always this question like, well, how are we going to manage something like Medicare
mm-hmm.
in that universe?
Mm-hmm.
We can do it. That's what federation's about.
Mm-hmm.
That's what confederation mm-hmm. is about. It's about connecting with each other.
That's right. That's
for things
right.
that where we have a shared concern.
Very cool. I was not aware of this, but it does seem very close indeed. I can't believe the strong towns thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about. It also comes out, the municipalism thing comes out of this guy, Murray Bookchin. And so Murray Bookchin is the kind of rumpled Jewish Greenwich Village philosopher who is behind a lot of the Spanish indignados movement. Mm-hmm. In Barcelona, of all things.
Oh, that's weird.
Yep.
Like he had friends? He had friends there?
Mayor of Barcelona, this woman, Ada Colau, is all about Murray Bookchin.
All right.
And his form of municipalism, which he got, by the way, from ancient Athens.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Read a lot of ancient history. So, but these things tie together, obviously, very closely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very cool.
Yeah, and the city-state was a city-state for a reason.
That's right. Yeah,
right?
A state-state.
A state-state was a city for a reason, because it had a functionality that belied the infrastructure that we've built, the modern infrastructure. Yeah.
There's a certain granularity where it makes sense and works.
Where it makes sense and it works. And actually, if you subtract our modern infrastructure,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
what we're doing now for the state doesn't even make sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Can we subtract our modern infrastructure?
No. I keep hoping. But you know.
Just wait.
Yeah. But you know, then we couldn't have chats with Elias.
That's true. We do need an internet.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm not sure we need the state to have the internet. So.
All right.
What did Aristotle say? Aristotle said, you know, more than 5,000 people, you're going to lose control, you know.
It's going to be out of control. He was onto something.
Yeah,
just saying.
Yeah.
Right.
I would set it at 300, but you know.
Do you want to move on to our
other topic? Do you think we have time? What time is it?
Been?
I don't know. Where are we? Do you know what time it is, Elias?
Whatever you like.
He says whatever you like.
Oh yeah, no. What time have you got there?
Oh, I'm sorry. I have 9:33.
Okay, he's an hour behind us, so he has 10:30. Yeah. So we've been going about an hour or so. Yeah. So this other topic is a little more free form, but
you've been head up and I've been head up.
I've been head up and I, you know, just
this week.
I gotta
I've been enraged, honestly. Yeah.
Well, no, see now Paul's finally sort of tasting the rage that dealt with for decades. And just,
it's not the first time, but it's really,
it's visceral now. Yeah, right. And you can't quite, you know, put a cap on it. I know. I just kind of, it's
what can I say?
I've come to accept it now.
I'm a hater.
Just a hater. Well, that's what everyone says to me. I'm just a hater. Yeah. You know, why can't anything be good and pure? What's wrong with you?
Really?
No. So the particular, the impetus this last week is the death of a certain politician, a senator from Arizona, that has liberals kind of gushing, you know, in this somewhat perverse fashion, you know?
Yep.
I would call it a performative gushing.
Performative gushing, right? And what was it? Was it the New Yorker or the New York Post?
New Yorker.
So, yeah, it said it's the largest gathering of the resistance yet.
Yeah.
Oh. God.
It makes your head hurt, right?
It does make your head hurt, right?
You're kind of like, what am I, what am I even looking at? Yeah,
no,
What did I just read?
I'm just saying, I've not even been watching any of this on TV, but just through the lens of Twitter, which is like an obsessive peephole, you know?
Yeah.
They pointed at different things as like, they come by your feed.
Like, oh, there's a little flashback. Oh.
Yeah, little clips, pictures, headlines, and comments.
Snippets.
And I don't actually want to make this entirely about McCain. This week I collected a huge number of articles and documentation and voting histories and things.
Because here's the important thing.
Yeah.
It's not about him.
It's not about him per se.
What this is about is normalizing the fascism that's been creeping through American society for the last 15 years.
Yeah.
Like fully normalizing it as our standard bearer of American life.
When we were getting ready, I was saying to Grace, so at one point it seemed like for a while there was emerging a consensus that maybe the Vietnam War wasn't a great and noble endeavor and success.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
That seemed to actually be becoming the consensus, bipartisan, historical.
That it was a mistake.
Yeah.
That was wrong.
And then even more recently, it seemed like maybe a lot of the pundits and politicians that had been quite so gung-ho about Gulf War I and Gulf War II, about the invasion of Iraq, were having second thoughts and were willing to put it in print or in public saying,
yeah, I was wrong. That was wrong.
This was wrong of me. Now that they all have their, you know, sinecure, their teaching jobs and their their posts as senior editors.
They got their
golden
parachutes.
Yeah.
And now they can admit to how repulsive what they did was.
Right.
Right.
Even people like Bill Kristol.
Yeah.
You know, so... But it seems like that's just been washed away.
We've managed to wash that all away.
Yeah.
Just clean the blackboard off.
Under some kind of wave of nostalgic, tear-jerking nationalism. I don't even know what it is. Well, you describe it.
Well, I think it's... I've called it this for a while. I think it's crypto-fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's not the goose-stepping in the streets... It's no one wears insignias.
Mm-hmm.
It's not openly revolting.
Yes.
Like, seriously, you're going to attack this woman in the street because she's whatever group?
Yeah, which is happening.
That's happening. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about crypto-fascism,
right.
which accomplishes the same ends, but it just has plausible deniability.
It's mm-hmm. part of it has to be that like all mainstream media is now state media.
Yes.
And social media is now state media.
So social media, mainstream media, it's also, and the reason social media is state media is because everyone's getting all their information from the state
mm-hmm.
through the mainstream media.
Yeah.
And so this narrative whereas 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you could look at ICE and you could say, dear God,
right?
We can't do this here.
Right.
This is the Gestapo. We can't have the Gestapo here.
Right.
To where now you've got to defend that assertion. Like, why would you abolish ICE? Doesn't that seem radical?
Right.
That seems extreme. Don't you think so?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the conversation we're having now, rather than the 2003 conversation about, you know, we can't have the Patriot Act is like, no,
it's bad.
It's just bad. There's nothing good here. Yep. You know, Homeland Security. You know what that sounds like? That sounds like Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And we mm-hmm. can't do that here. Mm-hmm. We can no longer have that conversation. Homeland Security is a department, you know, it's a cabinet level department.
Yeah.
And hey, there are lots of jobs attached to that.
Right.
You're trying to put those people out of work?
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's the conversation I'm having with people.
Yeah. No, last week we talked about how, you know, we can't have a universal health care because all the people that mostly women of color, low income jobs within the health insurance industry would lose their jobs.
Lose their jobs.
Yeah, that,
that's racist.
Horrible. Yeah.
You know?
This is right. Universal health care is racist.
It's actually racist. We have to keep doing what we're doing.
Right. The contortions are just, it's just
I mean, they're,
bizarre.
They're completely Orwellian.
Yeah. People in my Twitter feed are saying, hey, I remember this little thing where we all marched against the war in Iraq and the media didn't cover it, you know?
Yeah.
Did that never happen?
Did that go down the memory hole?
Yeah.
And that's really what this, what we're watching unfold with this sort of national spectacle.
Yeah.
With this death.
Yeah.
Is yeah. to what is to really just scrub clean the whole memory board and start writing a new story.
And it's especially
based on complete fiction.
Yeah. It's especially dispiriting even with people who you think of as left-leaning.
Yes.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders, all these people releasing statements that are just basically hagiographic, you know, just like wonderful life and career.
Robert Reich,
you know.
On and
yeah,
on.
Robert Reich. I unfollowed about 30 people on Twitter, honestly, because I just couldn't take it.
Just couldn't take it.
Well, so a question here is, someone called this the funeral of bipartisan self-regard. I noticed, you know,
that would fit in with this performative nature.
Yeah, right. It was also a very kind of elite kind of beltway, you know, Kennedy Center kind of moment or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's lots of garment ripping and wailing and beating of breasts.
Yeah. And so is it indicative of something or was it just a moment and, you know, we don't want to read too much into it. I tend to think of it, if there's a broader thing going on, the broader thing I have come up with is sort of Trump distortion syndrome. How Trump is rehabilitating, more or less single-handedly, the FBI.
Yeah.
CIA. Right,
the defense budget, and it just goes on and on.
Right.
Yes.
This is just...
I certainly think that's part of it. And I think one of the reasons that so many Democrats, you know, are groveling, you know, publicly is because they think that McCain was the anti-Trump, you know.
Yeah. Oh, somehow.
And so it, by doing this, they're, I don't know, owning the cons, you know.
Right? We're going to own the cons.
we will completely own them and make them look like fools. By joining them and giving them everything they've ever wanted.
And I like that term, the Trump distortion syndrome.
Yeah, yeah.
That suddenly all these things that we've known for decades,
right?
Were, is there any nice way to put it? They're just trash.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly are now
legitimate.
They're legitimate. They're good guys.
Yeah. Because you know he did that one last minute vote against Trump, right? You know.
Well,
there are several cases like that where he did these very high profile statements or votes, which were quickly turned around or invalidated by other less publicized votes.
It was because high profile because the media made it high profile.
McCain was a real gift to the media and he knew how to work the media and they loved him in particular because he gave them an enormous amount of access and loved to give interviews and commentary and you know do his maverick act
and I have to ask myself was that the point of the Trump presidency all along? I don't know. I'm just
the useful idiot theory of Trumpism.
Well, no, that all these things can be rehabilitated for public consumption again. That the FBI and the CIA are all trustworthy.
If we put install someone who looks bad enough, everything else looks good by comparison.
That George W. Bush, was not a moron.
He gave Michelle Obama a piece of candy.
He's a great guy, but no, seriously. I mean, and I remember during the Bush administrations, there were like two things that people would say simultaneously: that Bush was a moron. And that he was a
evil genius. Right.
And I'm like, he can't be both at the same time.
Now people say that about Trump too.
But he's not both. He can't be both.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So suddenly he's no longer an evil genius. He's no longer a moron. He's no longer a war criminal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's a sweet old man passing out candy.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's just, you know, don't you just feel warm and good inside?
Don't you miss him? Right.
Not at all.
Yeah, no.
Not at all. I miss him like I miss a canker sore.
And people don't realize, who haven't been around long enough to remember Reagan, that one day,
yeah,
love of Trump will be taught in every child's history class and in every textbook, and it will be undisputed, set in stone orthodoxy that he was the great man, the great man, the
great
theory.
Leader, the great, you know, don't you just feel warm and fuzzy thinking
great
about
leader.
Him? Do you remember the Christmas tree they had in the White House? How beautiful it was.
brutalist Christmas tree.
Wasn't that beautiful? It was really like understated elegance, I felt.
It's a fascist Christmas tree.
A friend of ours on Solidarity Hall, a very wonderful, smart woman, mm-hmm. has been nudging me over her sense that I am forgetting that the funeral, if nothing else, illustrated a momentary return of civility.
Oh, my God.
Not name-calling and labeling and blah, 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 blah. Well, and the point I wanted to make was, you know, and sort of the sense that there was a time when the nation's system worked and all that, and there was comity and so forth. And so what I said to her was, you know, years ago, there were moments when the nation's systems did work together and some worthwhile things were done.
Yeah.
But that has changed, and they're not working well. And the solution is not to look for the center. You know, her idea is we got to get practice because that's where things got done. And my sense is I don't want those things done.
Right. Yeah. The things that the centrist agenda.
I don't want that to
we
happen.
We don't want that to happen. Right.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Right. Whatever agenda you're talking about, it's probably not what you want done, you know?
Yeah. When you put the interests of billionaires and the interests of poor people in a balance and do what balances them out, right?
You do what works for the millionaires.
Yes, right. Exactly. Right. No, so there's no center. There's no center.
It might be very disruptive. It might be disconcerting. It's not controllable. But let us have no talk of just some sort of happy middle here.
Or that sort of faux civility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Faux comedy.
I'm not sure who, all these comments on Twitter by people saying, I'm a lifelong Democrat, but today I am, you know, I love McCain and Meghan McCain and all this. And I just have to scratch my head and say, when you're performing like this, who do you think is watching and what do you think it's going to get you? You know, they're not going to respect you in the morning, right?
No, they're not.
They're not gonna change their vote tomorrow because of what you said on Twitter.
Because the Democrats were all speaking of bipartisanship and unity. Nothing's going to change on the right. You know, they're not going to soften their projects.
They're still gonna confirm Kavanaugh. All this is gonna move forward.
Yeah, and probably the Democrats are gonna help them. Yeah,
and so, probably gonna bomb Syria.
While this was happening, the Democrats were rushing through the appointments of like a dozen of Trump's federal judicial nominees.
Right.
So
I don't know what I keep asking. What are they resisting? What's the resistance resisting?
Yeah.
It sounds like they're resisting the general public.
Incivility.
I guess.
People now think resistance is Republican senators who refuse to have lunch with Trump.
That'll show them.
So there.
Right. Yeah.
Not resistance.
Or like Alan Dershowitz can't get a lunch date on Martha's Vineyard, right?
Right. They wouldn't invite him to their parties anymore.
Yeah.
They did article after article about this controversy.
I don't think they've covered the prison strike once.
No, but they talked a lot about Dershowitz not being invited to parties. And how awful that was for him.
Right. Okay. So this for me is this sort of like, I was calling it normalizing fascism. Yeah. I really appreciate this frame. It's like this Trump, what did you say? Trump distortion syndrome.
Distortion. Yeah.
Like he somehow distorts things for your own mind.
Yep.
Like somehow now you can't see this the way you saw it 3 years ago.
No, that's right. That's right.
The facts as you knew them 3 years ago no longer exist because of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's like some freaky state mind control right there.
The idea that all these people speaking at the funeral, including Henry Kissinger, for God's sake.
Oh, my God. Oh, don't speak his name in front of me.
They are all somehow part of a collective resistance to Trump, you know, is.
But again, mind you, what I've said, my initial framing about crypto-fascism.
Yes.
What's important is that it's not vulgar.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's plausible deniability. And Trump abandons both those. Trump.
Yes, yes. Because
he's engaged in the same policy.
Right. It's like you always say, he is only working, he's only speaking to his base, and he's only doing things to energize his base, and it works.
And it works.
Continues to work.
Right.
Right.
It's a very effective strategy. It's very functional.
He's still holding rallies that look a lot like Nuremberg, you know.
They do. They really do. And I think if George Bush was a kind of a moron, I wouldn't exactly say evil genius, but he knows what he's doing.
Sure.
This isn't an accident. These aren't good gaffes. This isn't a mental health problem. No. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
And he's doing it intentionally to energize his base and solidify his power.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think for him, that this is about what he's going to get from the system. I don't think he's got any grand plan.
Trump, mm-hmm. you mean, or you said Bush?
Trump. I'm sorry. Yeah. I said Trump. So if Trump was a moron,
yeah.
I wouldn't. I mean, pardon me. If Bush was the moron,
right?
I wouldn't exactly call Trump an evil genius, but I think he knows what he's doing.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's about him seeing what he can get for himself.
Yeah.
It's graft.
Yes,
Trump's whole thing is graft.
Yeah.
The privatization of the presidency.
Right. Yeah. But this larger, broader thing that I see emerging, where he's distorting the whole political landscape.
Mm-hmm. Tilting the whole playing field.
So that, you know.
Something to worry about, yeah.
That's very worrisome.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
And I don't think he's doing that.
It's not really.
I don't think it's even him doing that.
It's not really worrisome because now we're uncivil.
No.
That's not the real worry.
Right.
The real worry to me is that we're all arguing about his rudeness and how he was playing golf when our neighbors are being rounded up.
Rounded up and herded out of the country.
Yeah.
I wonder if you guys, do you see any consolation in thinking about the way in which what we are learning here on a national scale is really the refutation of any notion of being exceptional?
I think that's deeply valuable. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we're all learning it.
You're discovering what most of human history has known.
Right.
Just how large national state systems in particular can go bad and all the terrible repercussions of that. And so because we've been in this exceptional bubble for about 50 or 70 years of prosperity that has cushioned us
from
the black
thing.
Yeah.
And so when that continues to unravel, it's a hard landing.
Yeah.
We're just like any other country, you know?
Just like anyone else.
Figure. Yeah.
And it's the same thing, you know, physics works for you too.
Right.
It's
like watching people. A few years ago, I went through a phase where I was very intensely studying all the climate change data and information coming out. And I went through a period of mourning. I did a series of recordings called Morning Valediction, where I was talking about climate change and talking about basically giving up fully embrace a stoicism, you know, about the future. That is sort of a lack of hope, but at the same time, hope for the short term.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, but people now are just starting to realize that, oh, maybe we're not going to fix this in time to prevent, you know, huge dislocations and population crashes and, you know, famine and whatnot. And watching them, it's a little similar, you know, it feels a little similar, like watching it now happen to people that are realizing, wow, the Arctic's going a lot faster than we thought it was going to.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the fires and, you know, so, you know, why you can't see out your backyard in Seattle, right?
For example.
But it feels a little similar. Like now people are having this political moment and they're seeing now in the realm of like governance and politics, what I was seeing about climate change a few years back.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
So.
And I was commenting to someone that this sort of normalization, and the, like this mass normalization, because, you know, even Obama served to normalize a lot of it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right? Really normal, because this is the thing with the child abductions at the border.
Yeah.
That was like new in degree.
Right.
Not new in policy.
It wasn't a new policy. Just the way it was implemented.
The way it was implemented was new, right? But this is a new policy. Right. Its implementation was new. And we found that implementation egregious and started screaming about it as a nation.
Yeah.
Largely because of this distortion syndrome, right? Mm-hmm. Where we're paying attention,
right?
And we can even see it or recognize it as grotesque.
And some of us who have actually tried to pay attention all along are scratching our heads
like, okay, now it's bad. All right, cool, you know.
Yeah.
And as soon as 45 dialed it back to basically the same policy as the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
The media basically moved on to the next.
Walked away.
Yeah, pile of red meat.
And I see like individuals who will bring this back to the table and say, this is still going on. This is still happening. Like, right. I see
they
individuals.
They haven't even met their court ordered, you know, deliverable by date.
And that's like this sort of normalization has gone on, been going on for a while, right?
Yeah. Yep.
But to see it sort of become, come forth as a standard bearer. I was talking to a friend of mine online and I said, you know, I have no qualms about punching a Nazi in the streets, right?
Mm-hmm.
For example, but I don't have a good response to this.
Right.
I don't have like a real, what I feel is like a really good response to this because yes.
Dan Carlin, the guy that does the Common Sense podcast on hardcore history, he's literally given up. He's done a couple shows where he just says, I don't know. We're in uncharted territory. Stop asking me.
I don't know. Right?
I've got no answers for you.
I have no answers for you. And so, yes. And we see that like the sort of the Antifa approach to the open fascist
was very
effective at tamping down attendance.
Right. At the rallies.
For the next rallies, right?
Yeah.
Where a lot of like physical violence happens on the streets and to specific targeted communities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, We've got a strategy, an effective strategy for that.
Right.
I don't know what the effective strategy is for this.
When it's the state.
right. Yeah. So my friend's response was, you know, there's only all there ever is. There's community and righteous anger and solidarity. Yeah.
Well,
that's all there ever is. That's all you can do.
I take hope in a comment that I've heard Chris Hedges make, mm-hmm. which is like when some relatively small portion of the population, and it's not, you know, 50%, it's not 90%, it's like 10%,
right,
just refuse, you know, to participate.
Oh yeah.
Things change. You rally, you know, that percent, you reach a certain point and the government can't continue.
They can't keep doing what they're doing.
They just can't do it.
Right.
Because
they don't have plausible deniability anymore.
Right. And, also, there's the it hits the economy too hard,
right?
And so all their owners are angry at them.
They're angry. I'm losing money.
But that's not how you get a big socialist revolution. That's how you get a.
That's how you stop the fascist gulags.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So.
I mean, and so that's why this prison strike is so exciting to me.
Yeah.
That, you know.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they already ended up like dropping phone rates.
Yes, like it's already having some positive impacts on the lives of incarcerated
people. And the Oklahoma school teachers busted loose.
Yeah, yeah. That's so good. These strikes are really great.
Yeah,
I'm glad to see them. They're pushing the needle a little bit.
Yeah.
And and some folks are waking up to some of this stuff.
Yeah.
But what it captured me when he said, you know, community and righteous anger and solidarity. Mm-hmm. That's just how I define love. You know. So, and that's really the only weapon there is.
And that's what gets you out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right, guys.
Are we there?
I think we're there.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks for joining us, Elias.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, we find light in the darkness. That's what we do.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Grace and Paul Podcast. Check out the show blog at podcast.blogspot.com, where you can leave comments or search for the Grace and Paul Podcast on Facebook or YouTube. Bye.
Till next time.
Bye, guys.